From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Rafael, California.
I'm from San Jose.
Hayward, California.
Nopa.
Kind of lower Russian Hill.
I live across from El Matate in San Francisco.
Coming up, we'll find out how much water it actually took to put out the blaze at Mission Bay in San Francisco.
Each of those ladder pipes pumps out about 750 gallons per minute.
Then we take a peek at this year's CAM Fest.
I'm hoping that people look at our program and go, this is different. This is different from what a standard film festival would do.
And we'll find out where the music comes from in this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
A lot of people graduate here after 4 years and thought it was automatic the whole time.
Let the knowledge ring today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. 2 days ago, the San Francisco skyline was covered in thick black smoke. It came from a fire that tore through a construction site in the Mission Bay neighborhood.
The fire is mostly out at this hour, but the smell of smoke is still very, very strong. Firefighters have been out here for more than 6 hours. More than 150 responded, and right now they are still pouring water onto those hot spots. Now,
Tuesday's five-alarm fire was the biggest the city has seen since 2012. Ultimately, 150 firefighters responded with almost 50 vehicles, and they used a lot of water. KALW's Ben Trefney spoke with Mindy Talmadge, the public information officer at the San Francisco Fire Department, this morning to get a sense of how they take on a blaze this big.
When they initially arrived on scene, they basically took a look and realized that this was a building under construction that had no fire safety systems in place. They realized this was going to be a defensive fire. There was no life safety issues. Their main goal would be to protect the surrounding structures.
And how did they go about doing that?
The way they did that was they accessed the low-pressure water system to begin with, and they applied as much water as they could to the buildings that were adjacent to this structure. What happens in this sort of a situation where there is so much fuel burning, the radiant heat becomes so strong that it can actually catch the other buildings on fire without the flame actually impinging on those structures. And in fact, what did happen here was that the windows started breaking in the structure across the street, and also the sprinkler system in that building across the street was activated.
And so using a lot of water from the low-pressure systems initially, but then they turned to high-pressure systems eventually, right?
Yes, that's correct. With this type of fire and so many master streams going, and the master streams were the ones that you saw coming from the top of the aerial ladders, With that much volume, we definitely needed the high-pressure system. And it was a lifesaver. It enabled the crews to get enough water between the fire building and the other buildings that were threatened to cool those down, keep them cool enough so that they wouldn't catch fire.
We talked a little bit about low pressure versus high pressure. The city is filled with hydrants that have low pressure capacity. High pressure is different. What exactly is that, and where do you get that water from?
Okay, so the low pressure system is the domestic water supply. That is our first line of defense when we're fighting a fire. We go directly to the low pressure system.
And when you say domestic water supply, where is that coming from?
That's coming from Hetch Hetchy. So now we've got the high-pressure system, and the high-pressure system is a dedicated firefighting system. It's unique to San Francisco. It's a gravity-fed system. It was a system that was built after the 1906 earthquake. It starts up at Twin Peaks Reservoir, which holds about 10.5 million gallons of water, and then there are holding tanks along the way. One is the Ashbury tank, and then one is the Jones Street tank. You can identify the hydrants that are part of that system around the city as the hydrants that have a very large diameter, and they have bonnets on the top that are various colors. They're blue, black, and red.
That's Mindy Talmadge. She is the public information officer for the San Francisco Fire Department. So do you have an idea of how much water you used in fighting this fire from Tuesday, Wednesday, and through now?
I can tell you it was millions of gallons of water. Each of those ladder pipes pumps out about 750 gallons per minute. Each of the multiversals, maybe 500 gallons per minute. Multiply that by how many of those streams we had going and how many hours it was going. It was millions and millions of gallons of water.
Do you end up making an accounting of that so that you can measure how much is left, say, in the reservoirs at Twin Peak and so forth?
Well, we can calculate it out based on how many hours each one of those streams was in service, and that is something that the company officers keep track of, how long they're actually using their streams or how long they've been at the particular fire. But the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir, actually, the water comes from there for the Twin Peaks Reservoir. So that is refillable. At some point, though, we do have other options to fill that reservoir, which we wouldn't fill it with seawater unless it was something that we absolutely had to do in the case of maybe a large earthquake or something like that.
So you could do that if you needed to?
We could do that if we needed to.
If, obviously, we're in a drought right now and people are, like myself, are being very careful about, you know, turning off the faucet when I'm brushing my teeth, which uses, I don't know, maybe a gallon or a couple of gallons or something like that, versus the millions that were used to fight a fire, obviously, necessarily. If the drought continues, would you consider using seawater in different ways, or would your practices change in any way?
Well, the problem with seawater is that it's very corrosive to the equipment and the piping and everything. So, you know, if that's something we don't have to think about doing right now, we would not do that. If we had to do it, we would do it.
So is your department involved with investigating what exactly caused this fire? What is your role at this point?
Well, yes, we are. Our fire investigators will investigate the cause. They have basically conducted all of the interviews, to my knowledge. They're leaning toward this being an accidental fire. And once that is determined, the investigation, to my knowledge, is closed. We are still down there as the days go on, and as they move the debris around, we will be there to wet down any hot spots and make sure that nothing flares up again. And then once the commander determines that we've done all that we can, then we will leave the scene.
That's Mindy Talmadge, public information officer at the San Francisco Fire Department. She spoke with KLW's Ben Trefney. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Just about 10 blocks from the site of the Mission Bay fire is the Asian Art Museum, where CAMFest, the country's largest Asian American film festival, opens tonight. The 11-day event showcases the vibrant local and international Asian film scene through movies, food, panel discussions, and music. Festival director Masashi Niwanu shared with us this year's festival highlights.
Over the years, my conversations with Grace have evolved.
Ah! It's so exciting! Guess what?
One of the films that I'm really excited about is our centerpiece presentation. It's American Revolutionary, The Evolution of Grace Lee Boggs.
I'm sorry. I think that if we stick to those categories of race and class and gender, we are stuck.
Pioneering activists in the African-American community, Asian-American community, and beyond.
She's been a Marxist theoretician, a Black Power activist, and has a thick FBI file.
Grace has made more contributions to the black struggle than most black people have.
A lot of what I see in Asian American filmmaking is reflected in this, and that is that we see ourselves in our larger picture. We don't see ourselves kind of in the shell of we're Asian Americans and we stick to each other, but we're part of so many different communities, especially here in the Bay Area.
So you guys look nice.
Thanks.
Where are you up to?
Okay.
Another film that we're very excited about is actually from New Zealand and is called Flat 3. It's a web series about three very spunky, charismatic females who live in this flat together, and it's exploding with humor.
What's your name? Your real name? Don't you think it's so weird that you're hitchhiking by yourself? On your own? You're a bit old to do that? Where's your girlfriend?
Just leave him alone.
Why? So one of us can go out with him and then you can...
Wow.
Do
you have to?
What?
Have no filter.
5,000 people like me this way.
Yeah, well, I don't. So, my little sister.
We always want to make sure that we are showcasing Bay Area talent. I mean, it's important for us. Equally as important to showcase huge international films to local stories and local filmmakers. One of them is East Side Sushi. This is a film by Anthony Lucerno and is shot all in Oakland.
We don't usually hire women for the kitchen because they have to lift the pots of hot water and the bags of rice are 50 pounds.
My daughter is 52 pounds and I can carry her for hours.
That film is a beautiful film because it mixes different communities. It's the Latino community and Asian American communities, and about this woman who starts as a dishwasher and wants to become a sushi chef. And we find out that it's hard if you're not Japanese.
Can you start tomorrow?
Yes.
One of my gems at our fest is called Directions in Sound, and this is our live music showcase. And this is where we celebrate storytelling through music. And we have five amazing Korean bands that are flying here to San Francisco and then heading back.
Well, it's the time, the red moon is coming tonight.
We do want to be a festival that reflects the kind of creativity that is in the Asian American community. So we do include web series, we have films. I'm hoping that people look at our program and go, this is different. This is different from what a standard film festival would do.
That was CAM Festival director Masashi Niwanu. He spoke with KALW's Melanie Young. And the song you're hearing right now is by Rock and Roll Radio, one of the bands that'll be featured in the festival. CAM Fest starts tonight and runs through March 23rd with events in Japantown, Chinatown, Berkeley, and Oakland. You can find a link to the festival at our website, kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. This week, San Francisco's Japantown is one of the places that commemorated the devastating earthquake and tsunami near Otsuchi, Japan, and the meltdown of a nearby nuclear plant in Fukushima. After the disaster, many Japanese survivors turned to writing poetry to express their grief, anger, and hope. Tanka is a poetry form that goes as far back as the 7th century. Last year, I visited an art exhibit at San Francisco State University that highlighted some of the Tanka poetry, which was written in the wake of the tsunami. Japanese literature professor Midori McKeon explained the significance of the Tanka poem. Historically, they were a main form of entertainment and were performed in the emperor's court.
In those occasions, there's an audience headed by the highest-ranking nobleman, and the courtiers would be seated in the order of their ranks. And a poem was given to a reciter, and the reciter would read aloud to the whole audience.
From the beginning, tanka was a way to express profound inner feelings. And the form, McKeon says, reflects a uniquely Japanese style.
The Japanese people really like economy in terms of its own language, pronunciation, and maybe their way of life as well. So, the shorter form, 31 syllabled shorter form, was preferred to more difficult to compose longer poems. 5-7-5-7-5-7-5-7. This kind of rhythm seems to be a natural rhythm, musical rhythm for the Japanese language.
Possibly the most telling of the tanka poems speaks of the Japanese resilience that people worldwide admired. This one is by Toko Mihara from Fukushima.
Ikite yukaneba naranu.
Because I have to go on living, even on the day of the atomic explosion, I am polishing rice.
Bakuhatsu no himo kome o togi ori. I'm sure her tears mingled with the water with which she was rinsing the rice. This, to me, this is almost like a Zen spirit. You have to concentrate on here and now, no matter what. And you have to do what you have to do now. And that's the only way to bring in the future.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. All week long on KALW, we've been playing you this sound. We sent KALW's Jeremy Dulmas back to school to bring us the answer.
My name's Jeff Davis. I'm the University Carillonist at the University of California. I mean, don't confuse a bell tower with a carillon. That'd be like confusing a living room with a sofa.
Okay, so
the carillon is the instrument that's at the top of the tower. A lot of people graduate here after 4 years and thought it was automatic the whole time. When you play the carillon, you're actually moving a metal clapper. A clapper is the metal piece inside of a bell that has a ball on it, so that can weigh up to hundreds of pounds. For a professional performer, it can be quite a light feeling. It can feel quite easy to play. For a beginner, it can be quite heavy and difficult to move the clapper over. I always tell my students this is the only instrument that you'll ever play in the whole world where what you practice on is not what you play. So the practice instruments don't play bells. They play tone bars like you'd find on a vibraphone, perhaps. So, what do you want to hear a little here on?
Yeah, that'd be great.
So, I'll be playing this at noon, so you get to hear it on the carillon as well.
Oh, great.
So you can hear how these are different things. So every minute here, you'll hear the clock mechanism. So all I ask of you is that you be quiet and stay still.
Okay.
Thank you.
The idea for visiting the Campanile came to us from a listener.
Well, my name is Lizak Shalit, and I was walking through campus, and I heard the Campanile, and I said, oh no, this is definitely something to tape. And of course, I had my cell phone with me, so I did. I stood there for quite a long time, taping and listening. And I've always loved bells, and the bigger the bell, the mightier the sound.
Thanks, Lizak. We love that mighty sound almost as much as we love hearing from our listeners. And this week, a lot of you called in with guesses. But there can only be one winner, and that is Paula Grove. Congratulations, Paula. You are the winner of a KALW t-shirt. For the rest of you, there will be a new sound next week. Here's a sneak peek.
Good play, bro.
You won't win.
He counted 15 already. 5. 20 to nothing. For now. Don't worry about it.
Think you know what that was and where we recorded it? Or do you have an idea for where we should record next? Give us a call and tell us all about it. Our number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. That's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Leela Day, Maya DePaula Haneke, Audrey Dilling, Laura Flynn, Nina Gensler-Debs, Linda Ju, Christina Loring, Julia Scott, Charlotte Silver, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Todd Whitney. Today's show is produced by Ashley Ann Krigbaum and engineered by Chris Hoff. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, and thanks to you, we are listener-supported public radio. The music playing behind me now is by the Farallon Recorder Quartet, which is part of this year's San Francisco Early Music Society series. They're playing on Sunday at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in San Francisco. Music starts at 4 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.